that at any point, if you have a question that you think needs to be answered right then, raise your hand and let's talk about it. My guess is that somebody else in the room will have the same question, or if I'm being talking too fast and you're not understanding, much better to tell me early than to tell me afterwards. I'm going to show a lot of videos because I thought that might help a little bit with the language. But I'm going to be here tomorrow and Wednesday also, so there should be lots of opportunity to talk if anybody is interested. I'm really happy to be here, and thank you to Gilles for inviting me, and to all of you for coming here in the afternoon. Is it possible to change the lighting at all so that it's darker in the front and lighter in the back? If not, don't worry. So, between 1984 and 1996, we published more than 500 laser discs, CD-ROMs, electronic books, and although it was early, a dozen web projects. I'm just going to give you a brief overview of those. So the very first thing we published was an edition of King Kong, which had the first audio commentary.
I think I'll annotate this.
We broke it up into chapters. You could listen to the entire symphony and get a running commentary in text. You could focus down on particular notes and hear them simplified and then in the full orchestral version. There was a game. It was hugely successful at the time. This is interesting because this is another video that we published. It's a terrific film about poets performing their work.
It's a poem for Larry Neal and Bob Marley, two black cultural workers that we lost in 1981.
The first one at the top, we made a controller so that you can put a CD into your computer, but control it from the web. We were selling fonts. We were doing a whole bunch of things that now are pretty common, but really had never been done before. And we did them on the web. So that's very quickly. That shows you what we were doing for these 12 years. Now I want to really focus on where did all that come from? Because I think that's really, in some ways, the more interesting story, or at least the one that it's useful for me to tell. So I come to you from the era of the book. I'm 68 years old, and I grew up with books. We didn't have any of this electronic stuff. We just had television had just come when I was born. But I really do come out of the book era. I have about 200 boxes like this, of boxes full of books that I'm about to do an interesting performance piece with. I used to own a bookstore, or not own, but I ran this bookstore, Revolution Books, because my background is very much in the far left, sort of the Maoist left. But in 1980, I had 3 children by that time, and I decided that I would stop doing political work, and I just started looking for something to do. And the very, very first thing I came across was an article in a magazine in New York. This is a business magazine, Business Week. And the article was about this new technology called the video laser disc. Oops, sorry. I just pulled these slides together so I may get out of order a bit. Hold that thought for a second about the laser discs. So before 1980, this would have been 1979-ish, I bought for my, let me see, he must have been about 10 years old. I bought for my 10-year-old son one of the first game arcades. And this was quite a revelation watching him play. I shouldn't say watching him play, I play too, a lot. But he was my stepson, so I can say this. He's sort of a genius, but he didn't read. And it was very interesting for me to watch how deeply engaged he got with these games, which by today's standard were quite silly. But I thought it was very interesting, and it became an important lesson for me that I thought about for a lot over the next many years, and was an important lesson. So, but then I read this article about laser discs, and most of you have probably never seen one. They're the size of a vinyl disc, and they were not digital. This was an analog medium. I know it looks like a CD, which is digital, but this is not. The information on a laser disc is encoded in the size of the pits, just like on a vinyl record. It's the size of the grooves that make the sound, or that are read for sound, and it's the same with a laser disc. Each disc can hold 54,000 frames, which in US television is 30 minutes. The very, very first thing I saw on a Laserdisc, because nobody had them, it was in a car dealership, where they were using them, and I'm gonna play just a few seconds from this video disc that I saw in 1979. And what you're going to hear at the very beginning is the download from the disc of the bits that will be needed for the machine to make sense of it. The machine was digital, the disc itself was analog. But what you're going to hear is the download of the bits.
Index to find whatever you want to play again. Oh, yes, I almost forgot. You can play the sound on the disc a couple of ways. Usually you play both audio number one and audio number two together. But sometimes you take a switch and play only number one or only number two. Then you hear something entirely different. Just follow what we say all along the way and it will be easy.
So here's an example of one of the, there were 30, I think, activities. Here's one of them.
Sign language is a special way of communicating without making a sound. Use slow motion and step frame to learn these phrases.
So this was all incredibly exciting to us because what we realized was that I realized that's simple. All I was doing was going back and forth between two frames. But we've never been able to do anything like that before, ever. And this was so much fun. And we just realized this was a medium where the possibilities were going to be endless, as silly and sort of non-essential as that is.
I can get that.
Okay, so now we're going to get much more serious, okay? Because those things I just showed you, those are the things that I saw first. Those are the things that grabbed my attention and that made me sort of get excited. But then I started doing some of the hard work and really trying to understand the theory of where all this was coming from. And I had one of those really lucky moments where I got hired by the Encyclopedia Britannica to think about the future of the encyclopedia. And the first sort of stop was at MIT, at something that at that time was called the Architecture Machine Group. It's now called the Media Lab. And I saw three things there. I'm going to show them to you. I probably should show this one last, but I'll show it. It's up. I'll show the first.
I can get the definition of these words just by touching them, and the definition will appear in the illustration corner.
Okay, so it's 1979. This was done. I'm seeing it in 1981. They had just invented anti-alias text at MIT. We're looking at a television screen. Up until that moment, for me or anybody else who hadn't been in that laboratory, the only time we saw text on a television screen, it was that sort of ugly green on reversed out on black. And you know, you would never read on a television screen. But suddenly, I walk into this laboratory and I'm seeing all of this text on a screen. And trust me, this video is atrocious. The text was crisp, it was clean, you wanted to read it. And this by itself was a complete revelation. But then one more thing happened that really blew my mind. Oops, sorry. Just not used to it.
I can get back to the illustration, but in this case, it's not a single frame. But it's actually a movie of someone coming into the frame and doing the repair that's described in the text.
So, I mean, honestly, this was incredible. This meant not only could we have, well, not only could the text be on a television screen, but what was really important was that the notion of the page, which for hundreds of years had been text and graphics, suddenly the page could include audio and video. And this just seemed to me to be an amazing development because, again, this went along with this idea that an artist, an author, somebody who had something to say was going to have a much richer palette than they'd ever had before. They weren't going to have to choose between text and video. So this is another thing that they had running in the lab then, same time, in the late 70s, these things were developed. This is called Put That There.
Pay attention.
Go ahead.
Load a map of the Caribbean.
If it's not clear, this is he's communicating with the machine by voice, and you'll see in a minute he's going to start interacting with gestures as well.
1979. That is it. This is not it. I'm opening your picture now.
Thank you.
welcome to the Caribbean. I'm waiting for you.
Pay attention.
Go ahead.
Create a red oil tanker.
Where?
There. Put a blue cruise ship.
Where?
East of the Bahamas. Make a yellow sailboat.
Where?
North of that. Create a green crater.
Where?
East of the sailboat. Create a magenta trawler.
Where?
There. Put that.
Where?
There. Move the freighter.
Where?
There. Where is Havana?
West Central.
Where is Jamaica?
South Central.
Move the freighter.
What command?
Move.
So I just wanted to throw all the way there because what he just did is really interesting. I'm gonna play that in a few seconds again. Because what happens there is he gave a command and the computer didn't understand it. But the computer knew it didn't understand it, so it asked him to repeat it. I don't know about the rest of you, but Siri never quite gets that good. It just says it doesn't understand, it doesn't ask me to repeat.
Move the freighter.
What command?
Move.
Where?
South of Jamaica.
So, this is the last of these at the ArcMap lab. This is the Aspen movie map. And the operator, the person is sitting in a chair by Charles Eames that has a joystick attached to it. And there's a big screen in front of him that he's going to drive through the town of Aspen, Colorado. The two monitors on the sides are just showing, for the purpose of this demo, are showing what's on the laser video discs that are being used to generate the image in the middle. So he's driving down the street, and he can back up just by pulling the joystick back. He goes forward again. He gets to the corner, pushes the joystick to the right, and turns. So you have... The first time I saw this, I was with a man who knew Aspen very well, and he sat down in a chair and just started driving through the city. He knew it worked flawlessly, and he could go wherever he wanted to without any problems at all. This is showing that anything in the map can be shown in different seasons and can also be shown in different historical periods. And then you're able to go, if you see a building that's interesting, you can go into the building. And there are all these elements that are taken out or put there so that you can see them. If you see a person, there's an interview with that person.
First as a human being, and then as a professional police officer.
So, Google Earth, Google Maps is getting there, but it's still a long, long, long way from what had been imagined back in the late 70s. Hypertext was a hugely important part of the equation. This idea that hypertext works in two ways. One is that as an author, I want to be able to send my readers in different directions at different times, or give them multiple options. But also, the reader might have her own ideas about where she wants to go. You know how you're reading something and suddenly you say, oh gee, you know, I wonder what if, and then you do a search, and that is hypertext. And probably, you know, as early as the library in Alexandria, humans have wanted to collect all of knowledge together, and increasingly have the concept of linking it together. I came across this film yesterday, actually, that has four little sequences of some sort of 20th century pioneers in hypertext. And I'm just going to show these very quickly.
Belgian Paul Odelay believed that world peace could be achieved through a global sharing of knowledge. He and Henri Lafontaine began summarizing information, classifying and cross-referencing it in a world palace of knowledge that ultimately held 15 million entries on cards and microfilm. When people sent questions, Odelay's staff searched the archive, retrieved information, provided query results, and most significantly, suggested cross-referenced or linked data, much like a search engine does today.
1937. And just after the Second World War, oh, you know what? Vannevar Bush reminds me, I've got to go back. So,
I can get a definition of you.
This work at MIT, the repair manual, put that there.
Pay attention.
And the Aspen movie map. These were all funded by the Defense Department. These conceptually were all tools for war. The repair manual was so that these guys were, soldiers were running these huge tanks, and they didn't have to repair them. They had manuals, the manuals would have been this high, so they needed to have some compact way to help them learn how to repair, so they figured they would use electronic media. Put that there, I think, is sort of obvious. Allowing people to interactively move things around the map, they're planning for battle. And the movie map was absolutely all about preparing soldiers to go into urban spaces and to conquer them. And the point was to learn the urban space through something like the Aspen movie map. So I think it's important to understand how war historically has always sort of been at the forefront of technological development. And I think that's not insignificant to understand because technologies come with their own valence, and when they are invented for war, it's not insignificant. So Vannevar Bush was the Secretary of War of the United States, but after the war, he did this.
At the end of World War II, American scientist and engineer Vannevar Bush published his concept for the Mimex, a device to augment human memory and index information. He believed people could navigate information quickly if the process of cross-referencing was automated. The most essential feature, Bush wrote, was the process of tying two items together. Information would not be organized by traditional categories, but by free association, one of the ways the brain links information.
So the Mimex, I would say, is probably the seminal idea in this whole movement for multimedia. Everybody has always been trying to create this device that could be used to retrieve any information at any point. I think a lot of us, whenever we, I know that every single tool I've built over the last 20 years, the very first thing I put into it is this amazing article, As We May Think, that Bush wrote in 1945, which laid out this concept of having all the world's information organized in one place. And here's Douglas Engelbart.
American engineer and inventor Douglas Engelbart read about the MMS at age 20 years later, working as an engineer. He wondered if computers with those tools could be interactive machines for navigating knowledge and augmenting human intellect. It was a radical idea. But in December 1968, Engelbart and his team at Stanford Research Institute publicly unveiled their experimental online system in what became known as the mother of all demos.
I'm going to show you some of the mother of all demos in a minute. And the last one is Ted Nelson.
The word hypertext was coined by Ted Nelson, author, sociologist, and philosopher. In 1959, he came up with his own ideas for navigating information with a digital computer.
So, the mother of all demos is 1968. Actually, I'm going to show you a little demo, and then I'm going to come back to this page.
These are a program that I'm going to describe to you is quickly characterizable by saying, if in your office, you as an intellectual worker were supplied with a computer display backed up by a computer that was alive for you all day and was instantly responsive to every action you had, how much value could you derive from that? Well, this basically characterizes what we've been pursuing for many years in what we call the Augmented Human Intellect Research Center at Stanford Research Institute. This room place that I've had here. So here, I'm afraid I'll...
So what he's showing is these are the seven places he has to stop after work on his way home.
So here's what I do with a picture drawing capability. Here's a slide of math. I start from work, and here's the route I seem to have to go to pick up all the materials. And that's my plan for getting home tonight. But if I want to, I can say, the library, what am I supposed to pick up there? I can just point to that. And oh, I see, overdue books and all. Well, there was a statement there with that name on it. Go back. What if I want, am I supposed to pick up the drugstore? I see, interesting. All right.
Our maps still aren't linked with our lists.
Oh, I've already seen that. I just don't like that. Gee, that's too much. Anyway, so we have this feature, the structuring our material hierarchically, being able to move around it very well. When we get a hierarchy, such as I can show you here, I can do things if I want to just select it, interchange produce and canned materials. Bingo. And they're all numbered right if I care to look.
So here's a list of all the things that were done for the first time in this demo in 1968. The mouse, Engelbart and his team invented the mouse. Two-dimensional display editing. Object addressing, which was required for linking. Hypermedia, which means not just multimedia, but also the ability to have hyperlinks. View control, multiple windows, cross-file editing, being able to change something in one file and having the changes reflected in another. Integrated hypermedia email, version control of documents, shared screen teleconferencing, computer-aided meetings, formatting of text, context-sensitive help, a client-server architecture, a universal user interface, and keyword tagging. OK? Okay, every one of those things was demonstrated for the first time in 1968 in this demo. It's about 100 minutes, and if I highly recommend it if you have the time. There's one really important thing I think to understand about Engelbart, who probably, from my perspective today, is the most important person in the history of all this development. But Engelbart's vision, unfortunately, has not really been realized. He was focused on not just the augmentation of individual effort, but the augmentation of shared and collective effort. And one of the biggest sort of differences between what Engelbart believed and what has happened is that Engelbart felt that a user interface, that the goal of an interface wasn't to make it as easy as possible. From Engelbart's point of view, the thing about an interface was to make it as powerful as possible. And he was willing to accept that people would have to be trained, that you couldn't necessarily just come up and start using one of his interfaces, that it took training. And unfortunately, in the interim, what has taken over is this idea that interfaces have to be very, very easy. And the problem with easy interfaces is that you can't go very deeply if the interface is naive and simplistic. We were talking at lunch, and I was reminded that a guy named Alan Kay, who's also figures very large in all of this, always gives the example of a musical instrument, that anybody can come and sort of, make sounds come out of a horn or make sounds come out of a piano, and that's not a bad place to start. But if you really want to get somewhere, you've got to apply yourself. And I think in general that's true, and that it's unfortunate that in our current world, there's a tendency to always go for the easy.
Research program.
I went to Atari because to work in the research group there, because they invited me to keep thinking about the future of the encyclopedia. And in order to convince the people who owned Atari, we made a presentation, and that presentation included 9 images of how we thought the encyclopedia was going to be used. And this is 1982. And you see these kids are walking around the museum, and they have terminals that they're holding in their hands, and they're able to ask questions. The encyclopedia, the intelligent encyclopedia as we imagined it, was something that was user-driven. You could ask it a question, it would know you, it would know how to start to answer your question, but you could keep going deeper and deeper as you wanted. These images on the walls are displays out of the encyclopedia. The captions are being generated by the encyclopedia, etc. This is a father giving his son a tour of 1960s rock and roll. And again, the image on the wall is a monitor, and the father is holding a terminal to give him access to the encyclopedia. And this one is a mother and her children. They're looking at a tide pool, and they're asking questions of the encyclopedia. You'll notice that there's a little antenna coming out of the terminal, because even though there weren't cell phones yet, we assumed it was going to be wireless. What's interesting about these three images, and it goes for the other six as well, is that while we imagined that the page would be expanded to include audio and video, that you would have access to all the world's information, we missed what was probably the most important thing about the internet, which was not that it gave us access, but that it put people together. We completely missed the network effect. When I say we, I mean those of us who sort of got involved at about 1980, who were building on all this work I just showed you. We saw the multimedia possibilities, but not the deeper ones. But that was our weakness. It wasn't the weakness of the people who actually developed all of this. This is from 1969. It is a graphic showing the first four nodes on the internet. University of California and Santa Barbara, Stanford Research Institute, University of Utah, and UCLA. The internet was invented, and this is pretty much the proof of it, to allow researchers who were distant from each other to work together. That was the whole point of it, was to put people together. And that had largely been hidden by the time we get to 1980, when we didn't have the internet, but we thought the big deal was multimedia. So I'm going to switch out of this for just a minute. We need 5 minutes. I just want to show you some recent work of mine, because 10 years ago, I finally did get it, that it was about putting people together, and I stopped focusing on multimedia and building tools for multimedia, and started building tools for collaborative thinking, really. And this, I want to show you two examples quickly. This is a novel being read by students at a university, and the connection is so slow, sorry. So this student selected this text and wrote this comment. Four students responded to him, and what you're seeing here is just one of the threads. And this has been in use now for a few years, and it's really fantastic to watch what happens when people think collaboratively. One student will say something, another student will say, oh yeah, that's interesting, what about this? And then the third one will make a synthesis that none of them would have come to on their own. Alan Kay, who I mentioned a minute ago, has this expression that point of view is worth 80 IQ points. And all he means is that if three of us get together and look at the same problem from our different perspectives, we're going to be smarter about coming up with an understanding. We have it working just as well with films as with novels. So this is a feature film sitting here in Social Book. And at any point in the time code, I could put a comment. And what we see is that people are having the same kind of complex conversations in the margin of a film as they are in the margin of it's one thing I have learned, though, is that coming out of the era of print, which is also the era of the cult of the individual, that this shift from individual effort to collaborative effort is a huge one. Really huge, and it's not going to happen overnight. And let me finish on that by showing you In the early part of my life, I was a follower of Marx and Mao, and I still have huge respect for both of them. I was not particularly into McLuhan. My son, who's gone on to become a research scientist at Google, was having lunch a couple of years ago with Alan Kay, who Alan was at Xerox PARC and the inventor of what we now call a personal computer, or the person who conceived it first. And Alan told my son Murphy that at Xerox PARC everybody was reading McLuhan. And I thought this was really interesting because most of the people in my generation who were in the streets and being political were reading Marx and Mao. But what Alan was saying was that the people who actually invented the digital world that we're living in, they were reading McLuhan. And now, at this sort of, at this juncture in my life, I have to admit that I have become a very serious adherent of McLuhan, who understood something that I don't think anybody else understood quite as clearly as he did, which was that it's not just that the means of communication change how people think about themselves and how they are in the world, but also that the time frame is long. The printing press comes in 1454. It isn't for 150 years until the first novel is published. It took humans 150 years to evolve the form of the novel after the printing press. Capitalism, the nation state, our very notion of the individual, they all emerge after print. And arguably, the shift from print to digital is a much bigger shift than from handwritten codex books to print. So digital communication is going to change everything about what it means to be a human. But it's not going to happen over a 5, 10, 20 year period. It's going to happen over decades and possibly centuries if we can manage to last that long. I just want to finish with two short clips by McLuhan. This is from 1975.
With the end of secrecy goes the end of monopolies of knowledge. There can no longer be a monopoly of knowledge in learning, education, or in power. Now this, I'm not making value judgments. This would seem to many people a very good thing. And it may well be a very good thing. I'm simply...
Oh, sorry.
With the end of... This would seem to many people a very good thing. And it may well be a very good thing. I'm simply specifying the pattern or the form that occurs when you have instant speed of electric information. You cannot have a monopoly of knowledge such as most learned people had a few years ago. You cannot have it under electric conditions. This applies to all professional life as well as to private life.
So in 1975, he'd already figured out that privacy was going to undergo an amazingly big shift. And of course, we now see in society a huge struggle going on around the issue of privacy. And I sort of smile when I read about it because I realize that we're just at the beginning of a huge shift. And here's one more quick McLuhan piece. This is from 1960.
When any new form comes into the foreground of things, we naturally look at it through the old.
Yes,
we can't talk that. This is normal, and we're still trying to see how will our previous political and educational patterns persist under television. We're just trying to fit the old things into the new form, instead of asking, what is the new form going to do to all the assumptions we had before?
So, I mean, that is, in a lot of ways, the really interesting question. How are these new forms going to change us? And the reason why it's an important question is that if we're not conscious of the fact that these new forms are going to change us, then we may end up being changed in ways that we actually don't like in the end. And so I think it behooves all of us, particularly those of us who are going into professions where we are inventing these new forms, to really try to think about what kind of future do we want? Because to some extent, we are inventing it. Thank you. One of the most important books for me, which happened to have been written by a very serious McLuhan at Isaac, was a book by Neil Postman called Amusing Ourselves to Death. And Postman said, he wrote this in 1984, and he said, you know, most of us have been afraid that Orwell's prediction was going to come true, and we'd be living in a police state. Well, in fact, of course, that is coming true, and we are increasingly living in a police state. But he said, but even more importantly, even a bigger danger is that Aldous Huxley's vision is coming true, which basically was that people would take, in Huxley's case, it was a drug called Soma. In our case, it's a never-ending cornucopia of amusements that come to us via the internet. And that it is very easy to not be engaged in the world that's out there. I asked, I'm sorry, I don't know if he's in the room, but the gentleman who is the director of this school, when we were coming here this morning, I asked him, what is the biggest difference between being a student when you were in school and being a student today? And he said that in my day we were more politically engaged. And I think that's true. I think that to some extent that the digital world has convinced an entire generation that they don't have agency, that they can't actually change the world. They can change maybe their own very private world, but not the big world. And I think that by and large, digital is still being used, or is increasingly being used, to entertain us and not to empower us. But, you know, it's a battle. You know, that's sort of the point I'm trying to make, which is that, you know, like it or not, you are actors on a stage, or in a battle, and the battle is for the future of humanity, and it makes a difference what we do. But that's not entirely clear, I think. Well, there must be one question for somebody under 50. Or just disagree with something I said.
translate in French. I would be more advised in English, but because it concerns your how you dealt with all the innovative things that you spoke about, so that yourself experienced at the end of the 70s, and how it led you to Asia and to your editor and publisher experience. So is it back there? Is there something to talk about?
C'est
juste, je me demandais entre les expériences dont nous a parlé Bob, et qui est de voir le disque laser par exemple, et toute cette découverte de la fin des années 70, comment ça l'a mené à Voyager, à son expérience d'éditeur Voyager. Comment ça s'est irrité tout ça?
For me, it's kind of simple. You know, I wanted to change the world. I mean, I had been doing that, you know, from the time I was in high school till I was in my early 30s, I was a full-time radical activist. And when I stopped in 1980 and moved into the sort of media, my ideology hadn't changed dramatically. I still wanted to do something that would help change the world. And learning, I mean, I had a graduate degree in learning, and so this was all to me about new tools for learning. And I think the tricky thing to understand is that I started with movies not because I had any particular interest in movies. I started with the Criterion Collection with movies because in 1984, when we started, the only technology that was really good enough to present something that was, this is tricky. So it's 1984. Apple IIs are out there. They exist. And people are doing things on them. But the text is reversed out. There's no graphics, really. It's ugly. I come out of the book world with hundreds of years of book design in my genes. And so, for me, media had to be beautiful. And we couldn't do anything beautiful on a computer in 1984, but we could show a movie. And so, I started with movies. It was really that simple. And the day that Apple sent me a CD-ROM drive that I took up to a computer, I ran to the house of the man I did the Beethoven with, and I said, look what we can do. And so we went from laser discs to the first digital products, because we could do that with HyperCard. And then, 4 years later, 3 years later, Apple sends me a prototype of the very first PowerBook. And a good friend of mine who was with the National Library of Vienna rips it out of my hands, comes back 30 minutes later. He's put the first 10 pages of Paul Bowles' Sheltering Sky into HyperCard stack. And it's just the words on the page and on the screen. And we both look at it and we say, oh, we can do electronic books now. So for me, the interest has always been in pushing the boundaries, mostly for learning, of what you could do with these new technologies. It made me not a very good businessman because I could have stayed with something and really made money at it, but I kept getting excited about the new things. Somebody's got to do it, and that was my job. But I think that fundamentally it came out of my idealism. All of us came out of my idealism, you know, for wanting to do something that turns out, what I've realized since, is that changing the world isn't so much of a problem. The problem is changing the world in a good way. And that's the trickier thing.
Thank you. Exactly. Could I be more specific?
Yeah.
You told us about the discovery of anti-aliased texts in the late 70s, and a decade after, you produced Beethoven with aliased text.
So, what can we do today?
Yeah.
Well, now you have anti-aliased text.
No, but how could you accept something like this? How could you, in terms of intellectual objects and production of intellectual objects, think that maybe aliased text is okay? I don't know.
Totally fair question, and I don't have a good answer. But here's the thing. If I had waited 5 more years, I wouldn't have been able to make something as fantastic as that Beethoven. You know, or, I mean, or the other way to look at that, I mean, here's my answer, actually. If I have a skill, that skill has been knowing when a medium was just good enough to do something that would pass, that would be accepted. You know, when we did the first ebooks in 1992, it was still alias text. It was horrible. We didn't really expect the people who were going to read those first ebooks. We were just trying to say with those, hello, someday people are going to read on screens. But what we also realized was that there were affordances that came from horrible aliased text that we couldn't get from beautiful printed text. In other words, I remember very clearly the first time I had a book on a computer. And I was sitting on an airplane, and literally, like, it was just like this. And I'm sitting there on the airplane, I've got a drink in my hand, and I'm reading a book. And I went, oh, wait a minute, I'm actually not holding on to that book. This is an amazing thing, you know? I mean, think about it, you know? Especially with a hardback book. How do you read a hardback book and drink at the same time? You can't, right? You have to put something has to give. You know, the president of Apple used to fly me around the world in 1992 so that I would lie down on a stage, on a table like this, and I would prop the power book up against my leg and show how I could read in bed with just turning the pages with my finger. It turned out that the kinesthetic relationship to a book is, on the one hand, beautiful because they're nice objects. On the other hand, they're not actually suited for a lot of the ways that we want to read, like in bed or at the breakfast table, et cetera, et cetera. And these were things I had no idea were going to be important when we did the first e-books, but actually they turned out to be the most important things at the very beginning. That plus the amazing ability to being able to search the text. I mean, for me, that was just huge, right? You'd be on page 187 of a detective novel, and you'd wonder about something that happened 100 pages ago. In a print book, you'd have to really want it to go back and find it. But in an electronic book, you just typed in the name, and suddenly you had it. This turned out to me to be really good. And very interestingly today, with e-reading, I prefer now to read everything electronically. And it has everything to do with the fact that I've started to mark up my electronic books a lot. I underline, I read notes, things that I didn't do very much with print books. Partially because I was raised to think you're not supposed to mark up a print book. And the fact that Amazon saves for me all of my markup on a special page, so no matter where I am in the world, I can go get all my notes from anything I've read for the last 5 or 6 years. This is fantastic. The fact, you know, and so the, I know, by the way, that this isn't what you asked, but I know that there's a lot of articles now in the States about how people your age don't like reading electronically. You much prefer reading print. And a lot of people in the publishing world in New York are all sort of laughing and saying, you know, pointing at people like me and saying, you stupid idiot, here, now, finally, here's the proof. Nobody likes reading on screens. And I, you know, my answer is that if you look at these studies, they're just stupid. That if people don't like reading on screens, in general, because a lot of these, for example, a lot of these studies have been with textbooks. Well, I don't know about you, but a textbook does not translate to a Kindle. The density of a textbook, the amount of information on a textbook page, is impossible to put on through an electronic screen even today. So I wouldn't want to read a textbook on a computer screen either. In the same way that if I could afford to buy the newspaper, I'd prefer to have the newspaper every day, because scanning these huge newspaper pages is much better still in print than it is in electronic form. To the extent that we don't like reading electronically, it's because nobody has given us yet electronic reading in forms that work for us. But wait 10 years, it'll get better. So. Yes?
I was a bit surprised.
Can you talk a little bit louder? Resting my idealist self or resting my sensible self?
Yeah.
You know, I guess I think we have to. You know, here's the problem. If we don't, what that means is that a very small percentage of people are going to have all of the real power, and everybody else is not. I mean, if you want to get dystopian, I mean, when I read what a lot of the sort of thinkers, you know, not thinkers isn't the right word, there's a whole class of people. And I don't know the names of the people in France who would fall into this category, but I call them the tweakers. And I call them the tweakers because their job seems to be to push on the institutions of capitalism to make them more friendly to the digital domain. But when I read about the world that these tweakers see as ideal, it only has a few hundred million people in it. It only has the people in it who actually bother to gather the power that comes from going deeply into a problem, or who have amassed so much wealth by controlling that information. And we have 7 billion people on the planet. What are they going to do? I mean, the questions that you have as a generation are so much deeper and bigger than the questions that my generation dealt with. You know, you're going to be overseeing the transition from analog to digital and making the world that, you know, who's it going to be for? You know, is it going to be for just a few hundred million people, or is it going to be for 7 billion? I don't know. I have no idea how to answer that question. I mean, if you said to me, okay, go ahead, you can design the world for 7 billion people, what would you do? My answer would be, I don't have a clue. Which is a sad answer to give you, but it's too early. Thank you for asking. Well, I'm going to be here for the next couple of days. I hope that some of you will call me.